Good morning. This is Uncle Don again with Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio at 88.7 on the FM dial. Good morning out there in Prince George's Chemical Smog. This is your Uncle Don bringing you another edition of Uncle Don Reads the Comics. I hope to enlighten, entertain, and infuriate you today. This is CFUR, college-friendly university radio. I'll have to find a replacement for that identification since we soon have a studio downtown at the College of New Caledonia. A touch of wishful thinking there, but it's a grand idea to link the college and university. It's time for these two institutions to build some strong bonds since we both have the same goals, namely providing educational opportunities for Northern British Columbia and overthrowing the government. More wishful thinking there. Let's start out today with some good old-fashioned anti-American material from the newspapers. The current tone is captured by the lead editorial in a Globe and Mail of the 3rd of July, President Bush Against the World. The United States of America has declared that it has won the Cold War. There's no doubt that it has the military strength by far of the countries of the world. And, of course, it has Gaud on its side. By virtue of these assets, it can do no wrong. Now the planet is its empire, and the vassals and other nations must bow to the Americans, which will always, by definition, be benign. Georgie Bush, who took office with less than a majority of the American voters, is telling the Palestinian people that they must democratically select another leader to replace the one they have already elected. Georgie Bush, who has been pushing a free trade agreement of the Americas, has been battering on the gates of every country, restricting the entry of Yankee goods and services, has slapped tariffs on Canadian softwood and the world's steel. Georgie Bush, who opposes subsidies when given by the world's developing countries to feed their people, has now provided massive subsidies to American corporate agriculture. These subsidies will allow cheap American agricultural products to be dumped into other countries at prices lower than the break-even costs of their own farmers, thus driving these farmers from their lands. Those lands, incidentally, can then be bought by American corporations to grow exotic foods and flowers for export to the USA. And those displaced farmers will be available as cheap labor to runaway American corporations which manufacture gadgets for the American market. Georgie Bush complains that other countries have leaders who do not respect the rule of law. He then abrogates treaties unilaterally. He unsigned the treaty establishing the International Criminal Court and is demanding that American war criminals must be subject to the same rule of law as the other 5,700,000,000 people in this world. He plans openly for future wars, for future crimes like the invasion of Iraq. Georgie Bush can ignore the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners of war by changing definitions. Now there are illegal combatants who can be hustled off to third countries where Americans can torment and torture them at will. Georgie Bush has ordered his goon squads to kidnap or murder the leader of a sovereign country, namely Iraq. Americans consider this legal. Georgie Bush is a dangerous man leading a dangerous rogue nation. Not since Hitler or Stalin have we seen such a powerful, dangerous megalomaniac in power. Georgie Bush has moved his nation to a position of isolationism and unilateralism. It is time to take Georgie at his word and let him run his country without consideration of anything or anyone outside of his borders. It is time for the countries of the world to recognize the United States as a pariah and isolate it. Stop exports to the states and stop imports from the states. Expropriate their foreign properties and cease to recognize their passports. In short, let them stew in their own juices. The United States needs the rest of the world more than we need the United States. Canada is in the unfortunate position of being very dependent on the U.S. for products and markets. This dependence was increased by Brian Mulroney and other America worshippers who led us in the guise of being Canadians. There would be a painful period of adjustment while we developed other markets and sources, but it could be done. The first step would be for Canada to abrogate the North American Free Trade Agreement unilaterally. Surely Georgie Bush, the great abrogator of the ABM Treaty, could not object. Think of the opportunities for Canadian entrepreneurs if we swept the Yankee movies from our video stores, got the Hollywood crap off our movie screens, stopped importing and manufacturing automobiles designed for Los Angeles instead of a cold climate, and restored the crops and greenhouses that used to flourish in Canada. After a period of adjustment, we could use our cheap power and skilled manpower to become world leaders instead of vassals of the American corporations. It is a dream, I grant you. I don't see anyone or any party in the wings in Canada that would be willing to face the wrath of the United States. nor do I see more than a handful of citizens here who would face the inconveniences of adjustment. Maybe Canada and the world deserve to be treated with disdain by the United States. We are mostly gutless wonders. By now, listeners must assume that I am against everything American. Not so. There are some enviable things in the United States. The U.S. is a great place to live, if you are not poor or not a prisoner. I grew up firmly in the middle class, and I was cut a lot of slack. It is a stricter society. In a stricter society, I might have come in for some real trouble. One of the better aspects of America is that you cannot throw six stones at random without hitting a college or university, or a prison, but more on that later. I have darkened the doors of several of these institutions over the years. My favorite is not one of the ones with the big names and the good football teams. It is Rider College, since changed to Rider University, outside of Trenton, New Jersey. This was the college that accepted me after my debacle at my first year of university, which led to my becoming a soldier. I went into this college in January, in mid-year, and found myself living in an old house in the city center that had been converted into a dormitory. I had two roommates who told me of the glories of the water fights that they had had the previous semester. Now, I was afraid of flunking out again. I was taking the maximum course load, and if I did not do well, I was going to lose the parental support that was helping to keep me there. My greatest fear was of having to rejoin the labor force. I explained to my new roommates that I did not countenance any disturbances of my studying. I told them to pass on the information that, should anyone come charging into our room wearing a water vessel and evil intent, I would take that individual and pitch his ass out of our large third-story window. I emphasized that only the first one through the door had to fear, but I would surely defenestrate that person. As a recent soldier of unknown military skills, I was taken seriously. There were a number of water fights during that semester, but not a hand touched our doorknob. I learned at Rider College that the size and reputation of a school are not as important as the motivation of a student. A well-motivated student, with minimal guidance from decent instructors and a good library, can get as good an education at an unknown school as a famous one. And having a famous school behind you does not necessarily mean that you know anything either. For instance, that noted dolt, Georgie Bush, attended both Yale and Harvard. I rest my case. Rider had a policy of taking in almost anyone who could come up with a tuition and was alive enough to fog a mirror. But they also made clear that the second-year class was half the size of the first year since they flunked half the freshmen. I liked that as it gave people like myself a second chance. It worked. Now, if UNBC would just have a policy of dumping half the drones who come in here, apparently to keep warm. Now, here's a note of cheer in the news. The Chrétien regime is going to cut out the middleman in the game of placing its advertising at public events, most notably in Quebec. No longer will liberal-friendly companies dole out the money for music festivals, auto races, and sporting events and take their cut off the top. From now on, civil servants will dispense and control the $40 million a year devoted to this advertising. But whoa, is this not begging the question of advertising? Who says that we have to advertise Canada to Canadians? Do we have to pay people to fly the flag or display the maple leaf at public events? Could we not find a better way to spend that $40 million bucks? If a public event is popular, we should not, as taxpayers, have to support it. If it is not popular enough to be self-supporting, let it go. Who cares? Of course, the recent garden party in Kananaskis makes this $40 million look like nothing. Our fearless leader dropped a half a billion on a 30-hour bash that yielded, essentially, nothing but photo opportunities. I could arrange a meeting of these guys and cater the whole thing for a couple of grand. If you have a pipeline to any of these leaders, please let them know that Uncle Don stands ready to aid world solidarity in this way. Noblesse oblige. Good news. A federal court in the U.S. has declared that the phrase "under God" in the American Pledge of Allegiance is an illegal intrusion of religion into politics under the American Constitution. Of course, the Sky God people in the states are up in arms. What next? Removal of "In God We Trust" from the currency? Well, the United States of America survived the better part of two centuries without either of these intrusions of religion, and it would survive, unfortunately, the removal of both. When I was a pupil in the States, there was no "under God" in the hypocritical pledge that we were forced to recite every morning, nor was there any God mentioned on the money. I guess that both had to be inserted around 1954 to assure the citizenry that there was some divine being behind both the country and its money. We certainly could not trust the politicians with either. Money is like religion in that it is backed entirely by faith. If I did not have faith that I could get someone to take my dollars, I would not accept them. It is this circular faith that keeps money afloat. In places where that faith has been lost, as in Argentina recently, the currency collapses since it had no backing by gold, silver, or anything else perceived to be of intrinsic value. I suppose you could say we have gone from a gold standard to a silver standard, when our coins at least were silver, to the nickel standard. If you want good hard currency, stock up on coins. Whoopee! Now here's an excerpt from a column in the Globe and Mail's Report on Business by Barry McKenna. Quote, even securities regulators readily acknowledge it was a sham sale. A group of corporate insiders borrowed millions of dollars from their own struggling company to buy out an obscure subsidiary at a ridiculously inflated price. The parent company then booked a windfall gain, sending its stock soaring just long enough for insiders to dump their shares. The insiders knew better, of course. At least one director, a member of the audit committee no less, waited 8 months to alert regulators that he had quietly recorded his biggest ever payday by selling 2/3 of his shares. Pity the poor ordinary investor who might have bet the luckless company was poised for great things. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission easily saw through the scheme, ordering the company to restate its bogus results and unwind the transaction. SEC officials also concluded that the insider who took so long to report his stock trades broke the law. Sounds like the boys at Enron, WorldCom, or Global Crossing? Good guesses, but wrong. The company is Harkin Energy Corporation, and the ethically challenged insider is the leader of the free world. The year was 1989. George W. Bush was an aspiring Texas oil patch tycoon, and his father was President of the United States. End of quote. Now, isn't that just jolly? We knew that Georgie was a serial killer of poor folk on death row while Texas governor. We know that he now has credit for killing more innocent Afghan civilians than were lost in the terrorist attack on New York. We know that he is a war criminal who ignores the obligations of the Geneva Conventions by spiriting prisoners of war to torture chambers in Cuba. Now we know that he is a common chiseler and criminal also. Who will announce that the United States needs new election and that Georgie has to go? What country will send its secret services to kidnap or kill him? He has had the gall to initiate similar actions against Arafat and Hussein. Turnabout is fair play, as they say. In my travels about 30 years ago, I passed through Indonesia on my way north from Australia. It was then common to join up with other travelers to form small groups so we could look after each other. It could be daunting traveling alone in Asia. I found myself traveling in the company of a couple, a man from England who called himself an escaped lawyer, and his wife, a nurse from Australia, who were headed for the hippie mecca of Kathmandu. Everyone was going to Kathmandu in those days. We met at a youth hostel in Australia and traveled together through Darwin to Portuguese Timor, soon to be destroyed by Kissinger's friends, then Bali and onward through Java and Sumatra. We were able to tell people proudly that we got stoned in Sumatra. We arrived in the oil town and seaport of Palembang, Sumatra, one evening by bus to wait for a boat to Singapore. When we debussed, and if you can deplane, why not debuss, in Palembang, after a terrible ride, we wandered the streets looking for a hotel. The local children, bless their hearts, followed us with taunts and then stones. The local citizens watched in amusement as we were pelted. They were good, fun-loving folk. We had to find a place fast and spent the night in the damnedest place which I have ever slept. It was filthy, populated with perverts, and overpriced, but it was safe from the kids. The next day we found a better price where the proprietor had a rudimentary command of English, the room was clean, and the beds almost big enough for a Westerner. I mentioned that Chris, the Australian, called himself an escaped lawyer. He had been through law school but decided that he hated the law and was drifting. Jenny occasionally worked at nursing, but it was not her favorite sport. So the two of them had saved some money and shoved off to Asia, as many Australian residents were doing those days. The well-trod path that they traveled was referred to as the Gringo Trail, as travelers mostly followed the same routes through the same cities, and in those cities congregated in the same cheap accommodations. They got together and swapped information with people coming the other way on where to go, what to see, what to avoid, and where to stay and eat. By profiting from the experiences of others, we could avoid a lot of potentially serious problems. In those days, Indonesia was a nasty military dictatorship. I have no information that would lead me to believe that it has changed. The police and soldiers were ubiquitous and the people were cowed. I've learned to judge a country quickly by the way the armed forces and police react with the people. Are they of the people or over the people? Do they queue up or push to the head of the line? In Indonesia, the cops and military were definitely the rulers, and they did what they pleased. A foreigner would keep a low profile and act very subservient if he was wise. So it transpired that we were stuck in Palembang for over a week waiting for a small boat that would take us as deck passengers along with a cargo of raw rubber to Singapore. Chris, in a poetic moment, described visiting Palembang as being like visiting Mars. That is, it was too hot to go out during the day and there was nothing to do at night. When we did venture onto the streets, we would immediately attract a crowd of local citizens who would follow us, grab our clothes, make animated conversation on the subject of the foreign hippies, and generally make themselves as obnoxious as possible. We developed some games on these forays into the streets. Sometimes we would attract as large a crowd as possible and then find a store with two entrances. We would go in one and the crowd would follow, leading the merchants to scream and try to keep them out while we ducked out the other door to attract a new crowd. If one individual was particularly obnoxious and bugging us, one of us would drop back and pretend to be interested in a store window. Then he or she would turn and mimic the person who had been following us. The other two would turn and likewise follow and bug the bugger, causing great consternation. We were not the most compliant of tourists, but what we did was in self-defense, I swear. We found Java to be much more pleasant than Sumatra. In fact, we stayed a few days in Yogyakarta, a pleasant if impoverished city. We were informed of a couple of jobs teaching English, which would have paid a pittance, but enough to rent a small house, feed ourselves, and survived. We turned down the offer since we were not ready to split up and they could not employ the three of us. Thus passed one of those forks in the road of life that could have led to other adventures. I found that a society as different as that of Indonesia gave me frequent occasions to stop and ponder the oddities of life. A couple of instances stick out in my mind. The first was while sauntering through a street market in Yogyakarta. This is an open area with a rudimentary roof where people would spread a cloth and exhibit their wares or produce. Most were pitiful piles of odd fruits, vegetables, handicrafts, or counterfeit Western consumer goods. But there was one woman who sat behind a small pile of broken glass. There were shards of window glass, bottles, and such in a disordered heap. We spent some time speculating on the economics of this product and the marketplace therefore. Who goes shopping for broken glass? The walls of the rich were topped with broken glass, but broken glass was a surplus product of their lifestyles, not something for which one shopped in retail lots. The only conclusion we could come up with was that the market selling was a social occasion for the sellers, and this woman went for the socializing without any product. Rather than sit with nothing on her cloth, she found what she could, broken glass. We wondered if we might have ruined her day by buying her glass. Another image that embedded itself in my mind is the cop, armed with an assault rifle across his back and looking suitably mean, sitting on a motorcycle that was sporting mud flaps with images of John Lennon. That was a real mind-blower. A friend sent me an article from a broadsheet newspaper that is identified only as the Citizens Weekly, and I don't know where it is from. It certainly was not our own local birdcage liner of a similar name. The article that fills three pages is on prisons in the U.S. and Canada. Having spent time at Huddle Lake and the Prince George Regional Correctional Center, I have some interest in the phenomenon called, euphemistically, corrections. For the past 30 years, the United States has been in the grip of right-wing law and order freaks who think that anyone who breaks a law should be thrown in a dungeon and left to rot. They have turned prisons from a minor branch of the so-called justice system into a major industry. Since 1980, Texas has built more than 100 prisons to house the prisoners that George Bush did not kill while governor. In the past 15 years, California built 21 enormous prisons at a cost of over $5 billion. In 1980, California imprisoned 23,000 people. A decade later, the total stood at 93,000. In 2000, there were more than 160,000 prisoners. The smallest California men's prison holds 3,500 men. The state now has 33 state prisons. It costs $4 billion a year to operate these prisons. This is a blueprint for Canada's future if the Alliance Party, or CRAP as they formerly named themselves, had its way. There are now 2 million Americans in prisons, the largest percentage of population in any country in the world, the land of the free indeed. While European countries incarcerate much smaller percentage of their citizens, they encourage responsibility in their prisons, in their prisoners, with an eye to the time when they will return to society. The American philosophy stresses control and obedience. Experts are finding that the men, and they are largely men, in American prisons are harder than in the old days. This is not, according to those who should know, because tougher people are being imprisoned. In fact, the expansion of incarceration is netting nonviolent offenders who would not have been jailed in older days. It is while inside of these soulless monster prisons that men become hard. As these prisoners are returned to American society, they are responsible for some of the more brutal crimes. Brutal treatment creates brutal men. Coincidentally, The Guardian Weekly reports that major crimes on a rise in the U.S. This short article says that the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program shows major crimes were up by 2% in 2001 compared to the previous year. We can take this as gospel, right? After all, it comes from the FBI, and we know that they are the good guys. Many years ago at Rider College, in fact, I took an introductory criminology course. The professor had just completed some serious postgraduate work where he studied the FBI's uniform crime reports in depth. He told the class that these reports were, without putting too fine a point on it, bullshit. They were designed by J. Edgar Hoover to justify the huge amounts that he demanded from Congress. As an example, these reports included the value of all stolen cars in the United States on the dubious assumption that they might be driven across state borders and thus precipitate a federal crime. And if your car was stolen by some kid for a joyride and then left down the block where it was found by the local cops, the FBI took credit for the value of that car as recovered stolen goods by the FBI. These reports were released at times calculated to strike fear in the public and loosen the purse strings of Congress. As with so many statistics, they must be taken with a large grain of salt. When I hear a politician use the word percent, my bullshit antenna rises and I duck. My wife just finished a book entitled J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and the Secrets from the Public Library. It is a thick volume full of horror stories about this founder of the FBI who ruled this secret world for decades and terrified most people of power in the United States with the dirt he had on them. He was truly a rotten SOB. Judging by the excerpts that my wife read me, I would recommend this book to anyone interested in the seamy side of American politics and its justice system. Remember, irate letters can be sent to Uncle Don, care of CFUR, 3333 University Way, Prince George, V2N4Z9. This is CFUR, Canada's favorite university radio, at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Stay tuned, more rantings to come. Our leader, Jean Chrétien, has offered to comply with the reductions in greenhouse gases required by the Kyoto Agreement if the international community will give Canada credit for carbon sink functions of the forests in Canada. It may just be a lack of attention on my part, but I've heard no more of this proposal since we have seen forest fires charring our country from Yukon to Newfoundland. Should we not have to increase the reductions of our carbon emissions in the light of the destruction of our forests and the added carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by these fires? Don't wait to hear this reasonable proposal from Chrétien. You heard it first from Uncle Don. Would you like to get away from the smog and clutter of Prince George and relax in a little-known nature reserve for a while? Less than 30 minutes from downtown Prince George is the Ferguson Lake Nature Reserve, a little area belonging to the Nature Trust of BC and maintained by the city. There is a small lake where no motors are allowed and canoeing is easy. It has a dock for canoe launching, and the lake is stocked with eastern brook trout for the fishers. There is a trail around the lake that is worth exploring if you have gumboots. The lake has been raised by a beaver dam, and some parts of the trail are mucky. Bring a picnic lunch and relax for a spell. Alcohol and drugs are forbidden, but what the hell? A great place to trip. Right now you can see the annual phenomenon of the emergence of the tadpoles, millions of them, that will become toads in a couple of weeks. This is a great show for kids to see how nature perpetuates these little toads. When these tadpoles grow legs and lose their tails, they will swarm on the lakefront in their millions, and the mature and the mature toads will then strike out into the bush, seeking whatever it is that drives their migration. A few days later, they will be gone for another year, I know not where. Finding Ferguson Lake is easy. In the telephone book, look in the map section. Map number 1 shows Ferguson Lake in Block 1A in the upper left. Follow Highway 97 or Foothills Boulevard north and take directions from the map. You will see Uncle Don You may see Uncle Don there as he lives nearby. I'll be the guy with the two dogs. I've bashed the United States enough now. Enough for this program, anyway. Now I want to talk about the war. Which war? Good question. One has to be specific these days when there are actual or threatened shooting wars around the world. This time I mean the war here in British Columbia. We can say it is a very real sense that the local so-called liberal government has declared war on its citizens. Like a tin pot dictatorship, this Campbell-led elected dictatorship is warring against the entire social structure that has been built up here over the centuries. The so-called liberals are not so much a political party as we know it, but a grand alliance of the greedy, the ignorant, and the stupid. It gained power abetted by a party that ruled this province for a decade and blew it. The people did not so much elect the so-called liberals as the New Democrats threw the government to them. Well, we are stuck with 77 of these corporate stooges in the legislature where they feel that their massive majority has given them license to destroy everything that is good in this province. Look at their track record. They have declared war on our health system. Hospitals are being closed, medical premiums have been increased, long-term care facilities are closing. The ambulance service is being allowed to deteriorate. Doctors and nurses are being chased away by poor pay and onerous working conditions. They have declared war on our educational system. Tuition in post-secondary institutions has been increased. Public school boards are being starved and forced to close schools while public funds go to private schools. The board of UNBC is being stuffed with liberal appointees. They've declared war on workers. Employment standards have been weakened. Unions are being undermined. The entry minimum wage has been decreased to a starvation level. Civil servants are being fired. They declared war on the poor. Welfare rates have been cut and other benefits eliminated. They've declared war on the old. Bus fare subsidies for seniors were eliminated. Old age homes are being closed. Pensions are being undermined by increases in medical fees. They've declared war on the environment. They have scrapped environmental regulations in favor of a, quote, results-based legislation, which allows damage and then promises to try to clean it up. They've declared war on parks. The concept of a park as a piece of land protected from exploitation and damage has been junked. Now we have so-called enterprise park. What in hell is an enterprise park? They've declared war on the concept of public ownership itself. Under the guise of what they call P3, or public-private partnership, they want to give away our public resources like our water, highways, ferries, electricity grid, auto insurance, and everything else that our government has done or owns to provide us with goods and services. This fits in nicely with the corporate push for a general agreement on goods and services that will throw everything open to international corporations. They have given a victory bonus to the rich and corporations. The day after the election, they gave huge tax cuts to the rich, followed by massive corporate tax cuts. Those making under $60,000 a year were given a pittance, and that was soon overwhelmed by increases in medical fees and other expenses. Is it perhaps time that the people that they call special interests fight back? When we add up who are called special interests, we find that it includes all of us in one role or another. Their concept of public interest is business, plain and simple. Are we all going to take this for another 3 years? I suppose they are just waiting for someone to take a shot at Campbell or one of his stooges so they can jump on their dissenters with physical force like any other miserable dictatorship in Bush's new international empire. Watch for the stormtroopers to come out to silence dissent like mine. On this jolly note, Uncle Don will conclude this week's diatribe. Tune in next week for another exciting installment. This is CFUR 88.7 FM. I guess that will take care of the little...